Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. A big day for moderates in Iran's elections. Iranian hardliners have been dealt an electoral setback, with moderates winning a majority in the country's top clerical body, the Assembly of Experts in Parliament. Two leading conservatives, Ayatollahs Mohammad Yazdi and Mohammad Taghi Mesbah Yazdi, were defeated in their bid to re-election for the important 88-member assembly. The body will pick the country's next supreme leader to succeed 76-year-old incumbent Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Iran's leader since 1989. State television reported Monday that moderate President Hassan Rouhani and his allies won 15 out of Tehran's 16 seats in the election for the assembly. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says he is hopeful that Syria's warring parties will abide by the new ceasefire agreement so next week's resumption of peace talks in Geneva can go ahead as planned. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
The UN chief in no way underestimates the difficulties of getting Syria's warring factions around the negotiating table to talk peace. But he says there are hopeful signs that the cessation of hostilities agreement is holding and could be extended for 2 weeks. Ban Ki-moon agrees several reported violations of the agreement are troubling. However, he notes, the members of the International Syria Support Group Ceasefire Task Force are closely monitoring the situation.
We can continue to deliver life-saving humanitarian assistance to many people, at least 400,000 people who are living in besieged areas.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA News. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says 9 pregnant women who traveled from the U.S. to countries with Zika outbreaks contracted the virus and that one of them had a baby born with birth defects. CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden says studies are being done about the link between Zika and microcephaly, a birth defect leaving newborns with small heads and other complications.
We know that Zika and microcephaly are associated, although we do not yet have definitive proof that Zika infection alone is the cause of microcephaly, although the evidence for this is getting stronger by the day.
The CDC is working with the health ministries of Colombia and Brazil, where cases of Zika are in the millions, to find out more about the complications caused about the virus. Pulling off pranks is a rite of passage for many college students worldwide, but a student from the University of Virginia here in the U.S. might have been wise to confine his shenanigans to U.S. borders. An American college student is being detained in North Korea. He's publicly confessed to attempting to steal a political banner from a Pyongyang hotel. Otto Warmbier appeared before a group of domestic and foreign journalists Monday in the North Korean capital, accompanied by North Korean guards.
I regret my actions more than anything. I apologize to both the Korean people and the government.
The 21-year-old was visiting North Korea with a tour group and was arrested last month before boarding a plane out of the country. He's been charged with committing a hostile act against the state with the help of the U.S. President Obama is set to award the nation's highest military honor to Navy SEAL Edward Byers, who helped rescue an American hostage in December of 2012 in Afghanistan. Mr. Byers said he plans to continue serving as a Navy SEAL. He said he's going to take whatever job or mission is next for him. The 88th Annual Academy Awards were handed out on Sunday in Hollywood, with top honors for acting going to Leonardo DiCaprio for his role in the film The Revenant. Best actress went to Brie Larson. She was in the movie called Room. Spotlight was Best Picture, and Alicia Vikander and Mark Rylance won the supporting awards for acting. Internet search giant Google has unveiled an artificial intelligence that can identify where a photo was taken, even without well-known landmarks, geotags, or GPS. The software called PlanNet uses a database of over millions of geotagged photos organized along 26,000 grids to compare different aspects such as building styles, languages, and plant life. There's some limitations to the software. For example, it wasn't able to identify remote or infrequently visited areas, and it's supposed to come in an app that'll fit on your phone. Joe Palkin, Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wu-Heben coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights warns that international human rights laws aimed at safeguarding the rights and dignity of human life are increasingly being violated by states for short-term gain. Speaking at the opening of the UN Human Rights Council's 31st session in Geneva, the High Commissioner said the perceived threats of terrorism and extremism are undermining fundamental principles of human rights.
That's VOA's Lisa Schlein reporting. Details coming up.
Also in Nigeria, the nation's former interior minister was formally charged today with fraud and money laundering, and the UN reportedly is sending three experts to Burundi this week to investigate human rights violations.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Cameroon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, hundreds of people may be dead after four Nigeria farm communities clashed with Fulani cattlemen over grazing rights last week. The fighting reportedly lasted for several days in the central state of Benue. A truce has been declared and President Muhammadu Buhari has called for an investigation. Nigerian reporter Paul Okolo talked to VOA's David Arnold about the president's reaction as well as the reasons behind the violence.
The president was shocked by the scale of the killings that took place, and the destruction that took place also was something that he felt was very disturbing. And that was why he immediately launched an investigation into the clashes. The investigation is due to start so that they can get to the root of this problem.
What seems to be the root of the problem?
It's usually overgrazing rights and sometimes rustling of cattle comes into play. The herders and farmers have traditionally clashed in several areas where they come together. It's usually as a result of the cattle destroying the crop of the farmers, or the farmers refusing to allow the cattle herders to have a free rein in the territory, claiming that they cause a lot of destruction. It is usually the case that when they come together like this, clashes always occur, and they lead to the loss of lives and destruction of property.
Violence occurred over several days in four communities. Can you give me a little more detail about that?
These clashes used to be with local instruments like machetes and daggers and bows and arrows. But in recent years, more modern weapons have been introduced. And then we've also heard stories of the cattle herders being very, very well organized in the military fashion. And so it's really gone beyond something that can be treated as a local clash. It's taken place across several states in Nigeria, from the north central to the north west to the northeast, and going as far down, as far south as the southeast and southwest. In each case, we hear stories of the Fulani herders causing a lot of mayhem, destruction, killings along the way. But of course, it's usually the case that both parties engage each other at some point, but the Fulanis always come back in surprise attacks, reprisal attacks, and launch very deep, damaging blows.
Do you have any indication of how many have died in the last few days in Benue?
Some talk about scores of deaths. Others mention hundreds. It's very difficult at this stage to say.
One of these reports indicated the possibility that there is among the Fulani a militant group that suggests that this violence is much more organized than in the past.
There is a group that is always available to advocate for the Fulanis whenever there is a clash like this. This is the group that is protecting the interest of the Fulanis to make sure that they continue to have their way in all the parts of the country.
Is it really possible to resolve the conflict?
This is the view of many observers and experts. As long as the cattle herding business is still going on along traditional lines, it may be difficult to stop them from clashing.
That was reporter Paul Okolo in Abuja. He spoke with VOA's David Arnold.
Also in Nigeria, the nation's former interior minister was formally charged today with fraud and money laundering. It's a case involving a stampede by desperate job seekers that left at least 20 people dead. Abamoro was arrested last week by the country's anti-graft agency. Two other former interior officials are charged with him. Tens of thousands of people had turned up to take employment tests in March 2014, but the $3.5 million in application fees that had been collected could not be accounted for. Moro and the others pleaded not guilty today in Abuja Federal Court.
Authorities in Somalia say they arrested six people in connection with yesterday's double bombing in Baidoa that killed more than 30 people and wounded more than 60 others. Baidoa is about 245 kilometers west of the capital, Mogadishu. Police and the local government say the center of the town was very busy when a car bomb exploded near the main market. A second blast, believed to be from a suicide bomber, went off moments later at a restaurant.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights warns that international laws aimed at safeguarding the rights and dignity of human life are increasingly being violated by states for short-term gain. Speaking at the opening of the UN Human Rights Council's 31st session in Geneva, the High Commissioner said the perceived threats of terrorism and extremism are undermining fundamental principles of human rights. VOA's Lisa Schlein reports.
UN Human Rights Chief Zeid Ra'ad Al Hussein calls the piecemeal dismantling of the international system of human rights law deeply alarming. He says this body of law, which was set up to ward off global threats, is being grossly violated by many states which pick and choose those parts that suit their political agendas. He says an increasing number of nations are reacting to the rise of violent extremism, the growing number of armed conflicts, and mass exodus of people fleeing for safety by disregarding basic human rights principles.
Many leaders are pandering to a simplistic nationalism which mirrors the simplified and destructive us versus them mindset of the extremists and fans a rising wind of prejudice and fear.
The High Commissioner says both international human rights and international humanitarian laws are being shockingly violated with complete impunity in multiple conflicts. He highlights the five-year civil war in Syria, where hundreds of thousands of people have been killed, hospitals and medical personnel purposely targeted, and where starvation is being used as a deliberate and forbidden weapon of war. He notes Syria is far from the only armed conflict where civilians are enduring frightful attacks. He names Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, South Sudan, and Yemen as a few of the many other conflicts where attacks against civilians have become the norm.
Survivors, particularly the most vulnerable, are forced to flee and become exposed to further violations. To keep building higher walls against the flight of these desperate people is an act of cruelty and a delusion.
Though not mentioning them by name, High Commissioner Zaid criticizes the growing number of European countries that are adopting restrictive policies against Syrian and other asylum seekers. He notes that after World War II, nations opened their doors to millions of displaced people. But today, he says, instead of repeating this positive move, states are treating those fleeing conflict and persecution with hostility, disarray, and xenophobia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580, and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Uh, I'm Yehi Suhib, 15 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. In Nigeria, the nation's former interior minister was formally charged today with fraud and money laundering. Authorities in Somalia say at least 30 people were killed in yesterday's double bomb attack by Al-Shabaab militants in Bayadoa. And the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights warns that international laws aimed at safeguarding the rights and dignity of human life are increasingly being violated. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A mass grave was found in Burundi's capital today, where the protests against President Pierre Nkurunziza were held last year. The government says more than 30 bodies are expected to be exhumed. Moses Habayarimana reports from Bujumbura.
A mass grave was found in Mutakura, a neighborhood in Bujumbura. Burundian authorities have accused those who were behind the protest of killing and dumping the bodies there. Freddy Bonima is Bujumbura's mayor. The Bujumbura mayor, who spoke in a local language, says that it is the citizens themselves who reported the existence of the mass grave and said that the truth is coming to light, and that those who didn't support the protests against President Pierre Nkurunziza and some ruling party supporters, especially the youth wing in Bonerakure, were killed. Two men have been arrested and accused of carrying out the killings of the ruling party youth wing members last year. 30-year-old Butoyi Jean, who had bruises all over his body, denied being involved in the killings. Butoyi says that he is just a charcoal sailor in Mutakura, where the security forces found him. He says he knows nothing about the mass graves. Amnesty International last month released the satellite images that were said to be mass graves in Bujumbura after the deadliest attack and bloody confrontation between an armed group and the security forces on December 11th last year that left more than 30 people killed in less than 24 hours. However, Burundi authorities rejected the report. Amnesty International said that there has been an increase in the disappearance of civilians and others. The High Commissioner for Human Rights reported 439 people have been killed since last year, and 262 arbitrary arrests and 263 cases of torture or ill treatment. As the country is pushing for an end of the current political turmoil through inclusive dialogue, uncertainty still remains on when and who will be involved in the talks after the five African presidents visited the country last week. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
In related news, the UN reportedly is sending three experts to Burundi this week to investigate human rights violations. The investigators are part of a unit established by the Human Rights Council last December to ensure accountability for human rights violations and abuses, including identifying those responsible. The investigators are scheduled to be in Burundi from March 1st through the 8th.
An international human rights organization is calling on the government of Mozambique to urgently investigate what they call executions, sexual abuse, and ill treatment of civilians by its armed forces in Tete province. Human Rights Watch says over 6,000 people have fled to Malawi since army operations began in October 2015 to disarm militias linked to Mozambique's main opposition party, the Mozambique National Resistance, or RENAMO. Diwa Mavhinga is a senior researcher for HRW in Johannesburg. He spoke about the alleged atrocities taking place in Tete province.
What we have established as Human Rights Watch is that clearly there are thousands of Mozambicans fleeing from Mozambique, mainly from Tete province. We have told us they are fleeing fighting and abuses and harassment and killings by the Mozambican army in Tete province. So we have seen that the camp that has been set up in Malawi, in Mwanza district, now has more than 6,000 refugees and hundreds are arriving at the camp on a daily basis. So certainly there are huge concerns in terms of fights between the Mozambican army and the opposition group RENAMO, but also the harassment of civilians by the army of Mozambique.
What types of harassments are civilians experiencing?
We spoke to women who told us of how their husbands had been executed or killed before their eyes, some because they were accused of being RENAMO and others because they were accused of failing to disclose the whereabouts of RENAMO. Families have told us of how their houses were burnt down, were torched, food storage, granaries, as well as their fields. So many of them that we spoke to said they lost everything because soldiers had burnt those things down. Some were physically assaulted, beaten up to get them to disclose the whereabouts of RENAMO. So that is the range of the types of abuses and harassment that many of the people that we spoke to witnessed and experienced.
What is Mozambique's government saying about this so far?
The Mozambique government has said it is committed to facilitating the people in Mozambique, in Malawi, to return to Tete province. But the refugees have refused to return, saying they are not safe in Mozambique and that the government has failed to guarantee their safety because these Mozambican soldiers who should be protecting civilians are the ones who are abusing and harassing civilians. So the solution of immediate repatriation does not work because the refugees do not feel safe and hundreds continue to flee from Mozambique on a daily basis.
You all are calling for the government to urgently investigate these alleged abuses. So far, has any investigation begun based on what you all are calling for?
As far as we know, there has been no investigation so far, and the government of Mozambique has not explicitly confirmed that it would do so, because alternatively, the government has said these people are not really refugees or that they are being abused not by government forces but by RENAMO. So we do not have a confirmation as yet that the government would investigate the reported abuses.
What is the condition of those people who are now in the makeshift camp in Malawi?
It's absolutely terrible. You know, when we visited the camp, they had just 4 functional pit latrines serving 6,000 people, you can imagine, and just 2 boreholes providing water for the entire camp. It is completely overcrowded with limited access to food and health facilities, and it is in a location that is not accessible easily. So you would find that groups supporting them, giving food and things like that, would have to travel from Mwanza district some 20 kilometers away. So if rains come in significant amounts, that camp would not be accessible at all. The people are extremely vulnerable in terms of exposure to diseases and the likelihood of, you know, outbreaks of waterborne diseases like cholera or typhoid, because many of them resort to leaving themselves in the bushes because there are simply not enough toilets for them or facilities for them to use.
And if they are refusing to go back home because they are in fear of their lives, then what is going to be the long-term effect of them staying there?
It would have to be for the Malawi government to ensure that they are moved to a more appropriate location further inland, because the other challenge is that the camp location is just on the border with Mozambique, just 300 meters from the border. So that also makes them vulnerable to security concerns about attacks that could happen from the Mozambican side. So the government of Malawi needs to commit in the meanwhile to move this camp further inland to a secure and safe location. Also note that, you know, this camp does not have any school facility, but more than 2/3 of the 6,000 people in the camp are children and women. So that also raises the concerns around there is need to ensure that there is access to education for these hundreds of children who are at this camp.
Diwa Mavhinga is a senior researcher for HRW's Johannesburg office. He spoke with me from New York City.
In Calais, France, today authorities are bulldozing part of the migrant camp known as the jungle. The French news agency reports 2 bulldozers have destroyed about half the makeshift shacks as police stood by. Over recent days, migrants had been encouraged to leave after a French court approved leveling the southern part of the camp. Activists have appealed to the court to stop the evacuation of the camp. Thousands of migrants and refugees had gathered there, hoping to sneak aboard trucks or ferries heading for Britain. Meanwhile, Macedonian police fired tear gas today at hundreds of migrants and refugees from Syria and Iraq. AFP reports police took the action when protesters tried to break through a fence on the Greek border. Just hours earlier, Macedonia allowed several hundred people to pass through before resealing the border and triggering the protest.
In news of the Zika virus, Honduran authorities say a pregnant woman showing signs of Zika infection also has been diagnosed with a rare disorder that causes paralysis. The disorder Guillain-Barré syndrome has been linked to Zika infection. If confirmed, the Associated Press reports it would be the first case in Honduras with both conditions. Zika is also associated with microcephaly, which appears to cause birth defects, including abnormally small heads in infants. In Brazil, health workers, including those from the U.S., are going door to door in a poor state in the northeast of the country. AP reports that the state of Paraíba has many cases of both Zika infection and microcephaly. Health workers are trying to enroll about 100 mothers of infants with the birth defects to enroll in a study. Also in the U.S. state of Hawaii, organic farmers fear efforts to stop mosquitoes carrying the Zika virus could threaten their business. Authorities are considering the use of pesticides.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Happening Africa. This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Dante AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We'll discuss the beauty of Africa with me, Esther Githui Ewart, as guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Authorities in Somalia say at least 30 people were killed in yesterday's double bomb attack by Al-Shabaab militants in Baidoa. In Nigeria, the nation's former interior minister was formally charged today with fraud and money laundering. And the UN reportedly is sending three experts to Burundi this week to investigate human rights violations. Coming up, we'll have music from Cameroon, and in our feature segment, the unveiling of the first solar-powered bus in Uganda. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Buhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning with a baseball great.
Kim, throughout February, our VOA colleague James Buddy had daily Black History Month segments on our Daybreak Africa radio show. And James wraps things up with a February 29th fact about Major League Baseball slugger Hank Aaron.
On this day in 1972, Hank Aaron signed a $200,000 contract, becoming the first player in Major League Baseball to get that amount of money. Today, some baseball players make as much as $24 million a year. In May 1970, Aaron became the first player in baseball to record 500 home runs and 3,000 hits. He is best known, however, for breaking Babe Ruth's record of 714 career home runs, which he established in 1935.
Sports? Hear about it first, right here on the Sunny Side of Sports.
Joining us on the Sunny Side of Sports is VOA intern Rick Narciss. Sporty greetings, Rick.
Hey, Sunny.
I understand you're a basketball player.
Yeah, I play at Marymount University.
Where is it located for our VOA listeners?
We're right outside of D.C. in Arlington, Virginia.
What are you studying at Marymount, Rick?
Communications.
What attracted you to the internship program at the Voice of America?
My advisor recommended it for me. We had a lot of students that came through this program. Well, not under you, but VOA overall. And I talked to some of them. They said they had a great experience here. And I thought I'd try my hand at it.
And what year are you at Marymount?
This is my senior year. Okay. I'll be graduating at the end of this spring.
So would you like to maybe go into the communications field?
I would really like that. Anything with sports.
Let's talk sports. Basketball. What level is Marymount University in terms of collegiate basketball?
We are Division III.
Okay, now, can you explain how Division III differs from, say, Division II or Division I?
Well, Division I, you get a scholarship, you can get a full ride and go to school free, whereas D3, your scholarship money basically comes off of how well you did academically in high school. So basically, you're going to get money for your brains and rather than your athletic ability.
Did Marymount recruit you out of high school?
Yeah, they came to a bunch of my games. They really made me feel wanted. Which was why it made it easy to go there.
Okay, talk about your basketball experience at Marymount. Maybe not so much wins and losses, but how you developed as a student athlete.
We got a lot of help from our coach. He was always there, staying on top of us, helping us plan things out. As an athlete, I struggled with some injuries, had a lot of concussions.
Wow! How was it from like contact on the court or?
Yeah, on the court, I ran into somebody one time. I went up a guy's tooth went into the side of my head.
Ooh!
Yeah.
Now, are there, like, what do they call it, concussion protocols in the case of when you suffer an injury like that?
Yeah, you have to retake this test a million times. And it's a test, I feel like, even at your best mental capabilities, it's a tough test to pass. You have to remember all these words, all these numbers, shapes, all these weird shapes. So it was a tough one to come back from because I couldn't, like, remember these shapes to save my life.
What was your most memorable game at Marymount?
Probably my senior night. My senior night game, I tied my career high in points at 21, had 9 rebounds, and had my career high in steals with 6. So it's probably the biggest one for me that I remember.
And how did the fans respond on senior night?
We have one of my teammates, his family runs this group of younger kids. They do like camps for them, and they're on a travel team. So they all came out, and after the game, I got a dunk at the end of the game.
Oh, wow.
And they all just came over, and they were asking for my autograph. Like,
well, that must have made you feel pretty good.
Yeah, I felt real good about that.
Let's talk more basketball, Rick. LeBron James. LeBron might be your favorite player, right?
LeBron is my favorite player, but Steph is making a strong case for best player in the world right now.
Yeah, great player, exciting player. Another exciting player, you recently wrote about him, Emmanuel Mudiay of the Denver Nuggets. You might even be older than Mudiay, right?
Yeah.
19 and starting in the NBA. What can you tell our listeners about that blog post you wrote, Rick?
Like I mentioned in the blog post, Mudiay is a bit of a world traveler. He was born in the Democratic Republic of Congo. His family left, came to the United States, stayed in Texas. They spoke French coming up.
Mm.
Then he went over to China to play professional ball for a year instead of going to college. And so he's been all over the place. Big fan of his game. He can really pass the ball.
He's a rugged type of player too, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, 6'5", big for a guard.
Yeah, he's a bigger guard. He's really explosive. Hard to stay in front of him.
And would you say Mudiay is an example of how maybe the NBA is becoming more international in recent years in terms of the players in the league?
Yeah, you've seen the NBA respond to like the international presence, especially with the Rising Stars game, how they've decided to split up the teams geographically. So Team World featuring all the international players and then Team USA featuring the American players. That game's always a lot of fun to watch.
Thanks, Rick. That's VOA intern Rick Narcisse speaking with us at our Voice of America studios here in Washington. Joining us now with a package of African athletic news is Mark Ouma.
Kenyans Bedan Karoki and Mary Washira prevailed at the world best 10-kilometer road race in San Juan, Puerto Rico on Sunday. In an exciting sprint for the finish line among Kenyans, Karoki pipped Leonard Barsotom to win the men's race. Both were credited with an identical time of 27 minutes and 42 seconds. Stephen Sambu was 6 seconds behind, while Philip Kiprono and John Mwangangi registered an identical time of exactly 28 minutes. Meanwhile, Mary Washira triumphed in the women's race in 31 minutes and 49 seconds. Ethiopian Olympic 10,000-meter bronze medalist Belianesh Oljira was 2 seconds behind. Kenyans Veronica Nyarua, Lynette Masai, and Monica Ngige Wanjiku followed in that order. In Japan, Kenyan Hela Kiprop and Ethiopian Feyisa Lelisa triumphed at the Tokyo Marathon on Sunday. Kiprop improved her personal best by over 2 minutes when she clocked 2 hours 21 minutes and 27 seconds, and in the process set the women's course record. Ethiopian Tirfet Tsegei held the previous mark at 2 hours 22 minutes and 23 seconds since 2014. On Sunday, Ethiopian Amane Gobena was runner-up. Kenyan two-time world champion Edna Kiplagat was third. She was followed by Ethiopia's Abera Kebede, then defending champion Behane Dibaba. Meanwhile, Ethiopia's Feyisa Lelisa clocked 2 hours 6 minutes and 56 seconds to win the men's race race. Kenyans followed Bernard Kipyego, then defending champion Dickson Chumba. Ugandan Olympic champion Stephen Kiprotich was fourth, ahead of Kenyan two-time world champion Abel Kirui.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Ouma of our Daybreak Africa radio show. Meanwhile, after the Tokyo Marathon, it was announced that Kenyan athletes Eliud Kipchoge and Mary Keitany are the winners of the latest World Marathon Majors Series. And Kipchoge and Keitany received some nice prize money, $500,000 each. The champions are the male and female athletes who scored the most points during the one-year scoring period. The most recent period comprised the following marathons: last year's Tokyo, Boston, London, Berlin, Chicago, and New York City marathons, as well as the men's and women's marathons at the 2015 World Championships in Beijing and the 2016 Tokyo Marathon held Sunday. Eliud Kipchoge won the London and Berlin marathons in 2015, while Mary Keitany won the 2015 New York City Marathon, and she finished second at the 2015 London Marathon. Joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports is Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Sporty greetings, Andrew.
Sporty greetings, Sunny.
Andrew, what is trending on this Monday in the sports world?
Well, even though it's Monday and it happened a few days ago, people are still talking about this amazing performance by Steph Curry, 12 three-pointers that he made in a game against Oklahoma City Thunder.
Incredible shooting performance.
It ties an NBA record, and the icing on the cake was that the last three-pointer came with 0.6 seconds left in the game in overtime, and it secured the Golden State Warriors the victory.
I watched the highlights of that, Andrew, over and over and over again. And what makes it kind of unique when you watch Curry, he is so far behind that three-point line. These are long-range shots.
And that was what social media was talking about. I mean, first of all, social media being so visually connected now, you had tons of people posting the video, rewatching the video over and over again as you were. And then just, you know, the absurdity of how far back he was, people just tweeting out and saying he's amazing, he's, you know, the greatest. To a lot of question, who's greater, LeBron or Steph Curry? A lot of debate about that on social media. And even the players themselves and the teams tweeted out saying hats off to him. Mm. The NBA tweeting out and saying Curry from the parking lot. So they're having a little fun with it. But the fans certainly too. Even, you know, Oklahoma fans, I think, were taking to social media saying this is pretty amazing.
In fact, I saw one meme. I think that's what they call it, meme on social media, where Curry was in outer space and he was taking that shot. Looked like he was shooting at the moon.
Yeah.
And he probably made the shot, I would guess.
I wouldn't be surprised. And it's funny you mentioned that, because I remember during the World Cup, we saw a lot of those memes that were very instantaneous, you know, Van Persieing, where he's kind of, you know, floating like Superman. So with Steph Curry, it's very similar. You know, it speaks to his status as an athlete, especially on social media, that people can plug him into these memes and he becomes kind of a pop culture phenomenon in addition to a sports phenomenon.
Andrew, I encourage our Voice of America listeners to follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. I received a tweet from none other than Hall of Fame basketball player Bill Walton, who thanked me for my comments after Big Bill posted a photo of him and his son Luke before a recent game between the Portland Trailblazers and the defending NBA champion Golden State Warriors with Steph Curry. Luke served as Golden State's interim coach to start the season as head coach Steve Kerr recovered from back surgery. And I told his father via tweet that Luke did a great job. In fact, he guided the Warriors to a 39-4 record, the second best start in NBA history, and then Kerr resumed coaching. And Andrew, I think my reaction, that's the second time Walton has sent me a tweet, so he clearly reads his Twitter feed.
You have a good Twitter fan there. It's always nice to have somebody like that as a Twitter fan. So,
what else is trending, Andrew?
Well, speaking of Bill Walton, I was watching one of the NCAA basketball games. It's the college basketball league here in the United States. The NCAA was a National Collegiate Athletics Association.
Right, right.
So it's college basketball. Bill Walton was at one of the games between Arizona and Utah, and it's starting to percolate that time of year again on social media. Everyone's wondering about the NCAA tournament. This is, of course, the 68-team bracket-style tournament where you play off and work your way down to a final two teams and then one champion. But
single elimination.
Single elimination. So a lot of questions about who's going to be in, who's going to be out. And that bracket will be released, I believe, in about 2 weeks. But over the next 2 weeks, you have the teams playing off, going for their conference championships, trying to make their way into the tournament. So a lot of people on social media wondering who those teams will be, cheering for their team, saying, I hope we can make it. A lot of speculation. So even before the tournament begins, this is a fun time on social media with all the speculation.
And I remember we recently talked about the Super Bowl. That NCAA tournament has to be one of the more popular sporting events in the USA.
Absolutely. And especially in the first 2 days of the tournament, you have, 32 games. And so it really is, as much as the Super Bowl is like a national holiday here in the U.S., a sports holiday, so is these 2 days of the NCAA tournament. Everyone's glued to the TVs watching. The games are rapid fire. About every 15 minutes, there's another
game
starting.
That's right. Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America social media reporter. Thanks for joining us again, Andrew.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And I'll see you on Wednesday.
See you Wednesday.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of The Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, the unveiling of the first solar-powered bus in Uganda. But first, some music. Here is Benji Matek from Cameroon with African Raga.
Angwa! This is Mr. Bobby's goal. Coming out with Mr. Benji Matek. Send a message to all the children on the floor. And this is for your son to make you respect your mothers, respect your fathers, respect everybody that is here around your altar. You gotta praise him, keep your dad, because he needs to give you every day blessing. Listen to my message right now.
Don't you want to lower some Tonja benu dipi nyangwa o abi ende na ebo manda kusinoni kae ebo manda kusinoni kae bona bana wolo senga e Tonja manu lo sangwa o e Tonja benu dipi nyangwa o abi ende na ebo manda kusinoni kae ebo manda kusinoni kae bona bana wolo senga e Ewo beba belalo solo
Eyo ni mabola ne Eyo ni mabola ne
Ye. USA! Demana,
Matek with Africa Raga.
Ugandan engineers at Kira Motors Corporation recently unveiled the first solar-powered bus, a 35-seater dubbed Kaula. VOA's Paul Ndiho visited Kira Motors in Kampala and reports.
For those who thought that it's impossible to manufacture anything in Africa, think again. Kira Motors, a corporation, earlier this month unveiled its 35-seater Kaula bus. The Ugandan car manufacturer is slated to start commercial production of the Kira brand vehicles and Kaula passenger buses by 2018. The cost of the bus is estimated at about $58,000 and is expected to create more than 7,000 jobs. This is just another example built by incredibly talented young Ugandans. It's designed here and built here in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The bus, codenamed a Kaula with its striking design, is one passenger service vehicle that commands attention. It has a range of 80 kilometers when fully charged, and it also has solar panels on its roof, which give it a daily range extension of 12 kilometers. Dr. Sunday Stevens Tagbowa is the state minister for higher education and technology.
We'll build this to address the public transportation problems. You have been in town, you have seen all those 14-seater things jamming all the place. But we said, whatever we're doing should contribute to us addressing the major problem of unemployment, which I think is very, very huge in this country.
It drives and feels like any regular passenger bus on the market. For those who had any doubts, it's time to let everyone know that Kaula bus has arrived.
Today is the Kaula Solar Bus, the first of its kind designed and built in Africa by Kira Motors Corporation, an automotive startup which started at Makerere University, and today it's a government program for industrialization.
Paul Isaac Musasizi, the chief executive officer of Kira Motors, says that the Kaula Bus has an impressive power and was designed to thrill and intended for urban areas rather than inner city use because of the restrictions on how far it can travel.
The uniqueness of this bus is that it has a powertrain architecture which provides for two power banks. One is the primary power bank and the other is the secondary power bank. This condition is transient. At any one time, the primary power bank is responsible for delivering energy for propelling the vehicle, and the secondary power bank is available for charging.
What distinguishes the bus's exterior design from most buses on the market are the details. Leather interior and smooth transition from glass to sheet metal that makes it look sleek. Doreen Orishaba is one of the company engineers.
It's really exciting, and it's interesting when you're out there, everyone is asking you all sorts of questions, and it's very encouraging to know that Uganda is actually waiting for this, and we are here to do this. We are here to have these cars out as soon as humanly possible.
Kampala, like many African capital cities, has a fast-growing population and a rapid urban development that has meant more cars on the road. So it's beneficial to have locally manufactured passenger buses that could ease roads jammed with traffic. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Working, and our engineer, Sidrak Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and the Coca-Cola Company have announced support for a new program in Nigeria under the Water and Development Alliance, also known as the WADA Project. The $2 million project will provide up to 100,000 citizens in Cross River State with access to safe drinking water and good sanitation facilities by 2019. This joint investment is aligned with USAID and Coca-Cola's shared focus on clean water provision as a means to help build healthy, sustainable communities in Nigeria. The U.S. government is committed to engaging in effective and innovative alliances with committed partners to support Nigeria's critical development needs, said William Stoyer, acting U.S. Consul General in Lagos. We are proud to collaborate with Coca-Cola to bring a sustainable and safe water solution to thousands of people in Nigeria, he added. During the signing event, USAID Mission Director to Nigeria, Michael Harvey, said, "Today we are consolidating a special partnership, one in which a private firm has joined with a U.S. government agency to contribute to a priority set by the government of Nigeria." USAID and Coca-Cola have collaborated in Nigeria since 2007. The partnership has improved water resource management and expanded sustainable access to safe drinking water and sanitation services in Kano and in Yugu states. The WADA project helps to control and prevent water-related diseases such as cholera, typhoid, and diarrhea by providing water and sanitation services, hygiene education, and establishing water, environment, and sanitation committees in communities where the project works. This new agreement will provide a framework to implement WADA and to allow the parties to establish a range of policy issues to achieve their shared objectives in Nigeria. The United States is proud to work with Nigeria and its international and private sector partners to give the Nigerian people better access to something all human beings need, safe drinking water.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk. School uniforms. Do you support a school dress code? Join host Sande Shomari and his guests discussing school uniforms. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We'll discuss the beauty of Africa with me, Esther Gidoy-Ewart, as guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.